So those who want to get to the toilet, please, off you go. Those who are happy where you are. You know, instead of actually having to go to the toilet and miss the first part of a talk, one thing you could always do, you can get these little bottles from the hospital, you know. And if you sit in the back...
I shouldn't say such things, should I? This is a Mark City sense of humour. But I must say that on this one time I was visiting Thailand,
and we decided at the end of a big ceremony to have many monks who wanted to get in a bus in Thailand and go and visit a very elderly but very famous monk. That was Ajahn Mahabua, his name was. It was about 4 or 5 hours journey in the bus just to get to his monastery, and then another 4 or 5 hours back again. So the head monk there, that was Ajahn Liam, his name was at the time, he told us, he said, look, you know, it's just too much to all these monks in about 4 or 5 buses to stop to go to the toilet. So he said, we won't stop to go to the toilet. 4 or 5 hours, we just go straight. But then he came down the bus with about 4 or 5 plastic bags for each monk's and about a dozen rubber bands. Why not? But anyway, I think the monks complained and eventually we did stop and go to a proper toilet. But nevertheless, the innovative ways which monks lived in those days. But nevertheless, for this evening's talk, you can see that it's very wonderful to see you all here this evening, a big crowd. But please also be careful with things like parking and other stuff. And one of the little stories which it reminded me of, I try to say something which you can remember and something which you can make sure you look at the life in a different way. And the story which came up, which I haven't said for a while, at least what I remember anyway. Again, this is always, I look at the audience here. I always like looking at the audience. Some of you are new, and some of you have been coming for years. Some of you are very old, and it's the people who are very old who I like telling these stories to, because I reckon that you've forgotten the last time I said this. And so, so you will appreciate it. But the story itself is very useful. And that was the story years and years and years ago, when there was a monk and he was living in a temple like this, and one evening he was woken up about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. There was a noise in the main meditation hall, and first of all he thought, could that be any monks who were meditating or chanting that early in the morning, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning? And then he thought, no, not my monks. So he got out of his bed and he went to investigate. And when he went into the hall, what do you think he saw? A burglar. A real burglar standing there with a knife. He was trying to open the donation box. Now, you know our donation boxes, sometimes they're very hard to open. Sometimes even at Bodhinyana Monastery, when we have to collect all the funds, usually on a Friday morning, even sometimes we can't open the donation boxes and we've got the keys. Sometimes we forget the combinations. So it's usually a monk and an anagarika does that opening. But anyway, this burglar, this really big rough guy, was trying to open the donation box with a big knife. And so the head monk, he got up there and said to him, what are you doing? He said, none of your business, go away. And the monk said, look, he said, if you want to open the donation box, and he put his hand in his pocket. What are you getting in your pocket? Don't do anything bad. Oh, this knife is very sharp. And the monk brought out the keys.
said, here's the key to the donation box. Use this so you don't have to wreck the donation box. Now, we had our donation box wrecked a few years ago. It took a long time to sort of fix it up again. But anyway, said, use the key. Is this a trick? Said the burglar. I'm trying to do a burglar voice. Is it convincing at all? You're very kind. I know it's not convincing at all, but nevertheless, if I did try to burgle anything, people would start laughing. So anyway, where was I? Oh yeah, is this a trick? No, here's the key. Open the box. These are donations which people make out of their kindness of their heart. You obviously need something, so please, take some money if you need some money. And this was genuine. Genuine kindness. Isn't that a wonderful thing to do? So anyway, the thief took the key, and it actually worked. It wasn't a joke. He started emptying the donation box. There wasn't that much in there. And then the monk looked at the thief. The thief was one eye in the box and one eye on the monk. Don't know how they can do that, but he managed. And then the monk said, when was the last time you had a meal? None of your business! And the monk said, in the cupboard just above the donation box, there's some food which was left over from this morning. Please help yourself. And the thief was very, very, is this a meal? What's happening here? He said, no, come on, please have some yourself. We don't need it. And so when the thief had finished filling his pockets with the cash from the donation box, he topped up the cash with some food, which the monk very happily gave him, still pointing the knife at the monk. And then the monk said, now please go in peace. And don't call the police, said the thief. Why should I call the police? Said the monk. I've given you that money. I've given you that food. Please just go in peace. So off the thief went. And the following morning, you know, we do have committees and stuff. So the monk had to explain to the committee where the money went to and where the food had gone to. You know, sometimes that people understand this is like a spiritual thing. Can't we help people who really need it? If it really is helping them. So eventually, and that's based on many stories. I've heard many stories like this. Even years and years and years ago when I was growing up as a monk, as a head monk who just, and this was in the Ayutthaya province in Thailand years ago, where they would use boats to be able to go from one place to another. Even the monks would go on arms round in these boats because it's the only real means of transport. And so that one of these poor people was stealing a boat one day. And so what happened was that the monk woke up and found him, and the guy, you know, was just really sort of scared being caught by a monk. But all the monk did was say, look, here's the key, and open. And said, if you need a boat, take one. And when everybody in that area found out the kindness and generosity of a monk, it's not just we receive things, can't we give things as well? And so they actually donated about 3 or 4 boats. So he actually made a profit from that. Or even here some years ago, I remember seeing in the West Australian newspaper that somebody actually gave me a copy of it. I should have kept it, but it was many years ago. There was a boy coming home from school. He just got given, it was his birthday a couple of days previously, a big BMX bike. A nice bike. He loved his bike. But then he saw some bigger kids. They had caught a rabbit. And they were actually torturing the rabbit. You know, they really, I'm not quite sure why they were doing that. But the kids stopped. And these were bigger kids. And he said to the bigger kids, leave that rabbit alone. What's that rabbit done to you? And the two bigger kids told him to, you know, go off. He didn't actually say those words, apparently, but, you know. And he said, no. And then the little kid said, I will give you my bike if you give me the rabbit. This was a new bike, very expensive. So the two other kids gave him the rabbit. They did that exchange. When he got home, his mum and dad said, "Where's your bike gone?" When he told the story, they knew somebody in the newspaper, and they put that in the front page of the West Australian newspaper that day. A really inspiring story. It's much better to see stories like that in the front page than some of the other stuff you see in the newspapers. And there was a wonderful kid. He preferred to actually save the life of a little rabbit at the expense of his bike. Of course, you know what happened. There's another story, follow-up story the next day. Three bikes he was given. Dealers had seen that he'd done something very beautiful, and they sent new BMX bikes to his house. He lost one, but he got two and saved the life of a good rabbit. So stories like that, you always see those, and they're wonderful. It's real. So anyway, this monk, he noticed in the newspaper the next couple of days that thief had been caught. That's what happens, you know, you eventually do bad stuff, eventually it comes round to you, the bad karma comes up. He was put in jail for 10 years for all the thievery he'd done. But you know, that some of the senior monks, we live a long life. We always have to keep on working and working and working. You know how long I've been here over in Perth? It's about 39 years now, almost 40 years. I've been a monk for 48 years now, and most of those years here in Perth. Any sign of retirement yet? No. Doesn't matter. But anyway, some of these monks live a long life, and so this monk, 10 years later, he was woken up in the middle of the night. There was a sound in the hall. And he came out and had a look to check what was going on. And what do you think he saw in the hall with a big knife next to the donation box? The thief! The monastery, the temple was being burgled a second time. And this time there was no argument. The thief said, "Do you remember me?" Pointing the knife at the monk. The monk said, "Yeah, I remember you. Here's the key." And at that, the thief put down his knife. And he said, "I'm not trying to steal the money this time. I was just released a few days ago from prison. And for 10 years, I've been in that cell thinking about you. You're the only person I've ever met who was not scared, who was not upset that having the donation box opened and stolen. You actually cared for me. You gave me the key and told me to take as much as I wanted. And you even told me to take some food as well, I was so hungry. You're the first person who's been kind and generous to me in all these years. And I couldn't get you out of my head for 10 years being in jail. But I'll tell you, I've come to steal from you again. That's why I'm here, to steal. But last time I was here, I stole the wrong things. I stole money and food. This time, I want to steal the secret of kindness and generosity. Please teach me. If you needed something here, which would you rather have? Money, food, or this beautiful softness of heart, this peace, this generosity, this kindness, ability to forgive. For you, what's most important?" So the guy in the story stayed in the temple, became a monk, and he learned, eventually stole the right things this time. Not really stealing, but sharing. And I love stories like that. You may have heard them before. They're probably written in the books and been translated into many languages. But they're stories which make you see things in a different way. And that's one of the reasons why I love teaching. It's not just to say that you shouldn't steal, it's wrong to steal, especially things which are really important to people, but there are some things which aren't stealing, which are sharing. Sharing these secrets of peace and happiness, and learning to look at life in a totally different way. And that's some of the things which I love as Buddhists. Somebody did ask me earlier, can you please talk about what to do when everything goes wrong in life? So straight away, you stop that story at the very beginning. Everything goes wrong in life. What do you mean, wrong? You've heard me say this before, that if you go to the doctor and you're sick, how many people say, there's something wrong with me, doctor, I'm sick? Is there anything wrong with being sick? Have you made a mistake? Is your body not functioning properly? Is it not doing what it's supposed to do, to tell you that if you've got a bacteria, you can get a fever, or if you've broken a leg, you can't walk, you've got to heal? This is nature's way of healing things. It's not wrong. You could even say, there's something right with me. I'm sick again. The last time I saw you at New Year's Eve, I wasn't sick. I was tired. I've been really busy just overseas and doing New Year's Eve stuff. And so I was quite exhausted. So there's nothing wrong with being exhausted. It's wonderful I could actually be able to serve so much. And hopefully you enjoyed those New Year's Eve talks and the messing around we usually do. Because sometimes I love messing around. It's not just my character. I encourage myself to. Putting the humour in Buddhism. And I thought, there was one person who wrote an email or something saying, can you please talk more about putting humour in Buddhism? It's really easy to do. There's so many wonderful stories about putting humour into Buddhism before I go back on the track about things going wrong. Such as when somebody dies. I don't know if you've heard about the Buddhist coroner. Now, the coroner is somebody who has to find out the cause of death. And this Buddhist coroner, he got the job as the official coroner here in Western Australia. He didn't last very long, only just a few months he got the sack. Because he always put the same cause of death on. Birth. Why did he die? Because he was born. That's dumber. Even the Buddha said that. If you're born, you're going to die. So that's the cause of death. So if you've got somebody who's died recently, they say, well, what did they die of? Birth. Okay. Let's go back to when things go wrong. They just did go wrong. Well, when you change the attitude, is it really gone wrong? Just like when I was at school, I know I should be a teacher before I was a monk. And I just told this to somebody just earlier. I do recall that I thought that might be a kind of a good job to try before I became a monk. And so I thought, at least, you know, for my family, I was actually trying something ordinary, you know, before I went off to Thailand to ordain as a monk. So I did 1 year of teaching. That was 1973 to 1974. So anyway, the very first term there, in those schools, it's a high school in Devon in UK, the teacher always used to have to do the assembly in the morning. It had to be something religious. And when I was told I had to do the assembly the next week, that's, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, all the school were there and I had to do something. And I was, you know, a teacher, and they said, well, I don't know what to do. And I said, I'm not a Christian, I was a Buddhist even then. So I asked the principal, is it okay if from those morning assemblies, first thing in the morning, I teach some meditation to the kids? And they said, yeah, why not? And that was in 1973. And there were 650 boys and girls from 11-year-olds to 17-year-olds at that school, high school. And 11 to 17-year-olds, I say, I'm now going to teach you meditation. They didn't know what meditation was at all. I remember just sitting there on the stage and all of the children in front of me, 650 of them, 11-year-olds and 17-year-olds. Now please, you're sitting on the floor already, now please straighten your backs. And I'll never forget that, because I think these days they call it like a Mexican wave. Everybody, 650 kids, all at the same time, they straightened up. And they said, now just put your right hand over your left hand. Now close your eyes and put in your chin. And now start breathing in and breathing out. Just simple breath meditation. And everybody complied. And that was the amazing thing. It's only afterwards, after it was completed, one of the teachers, I think the senior English teacher, said, what would you have done if one of those children had started giggling? And then I actually broke into a sweat, because I realized it just needed one kid to start, and then the whole 650 would be gone. But I never thought of that. And of course, because I never thought of it, it never happened. And those 650 kids sat really peacefully, only for 5 minutes, you know, the morning assembly. And then afterwards, it's okay, thank you very much, it's finished. And one thing I always remember was they, all of them, 650 kids in unison, gave me an ovation, started clapping. And I thought, how sweet that was. So I continued that 4 days, day after day after day, for those four mornings. It was a real success, amazing. They loved it. And so that's one of the reasons why, when things go wrong, if you think it's going to go wrong, then it usually does. If you pull that out of your mind, no, maybe it's not going to go wrong. Maybe it's going to go right. And if you think it's going to go right, it usually does. So sometimes, as a Buddhist monk, I'm teaching you mob for years and years, they don't ever think it's going to go wrong. Think it's going to go right. And that you're increasing your chances. Just little things like you're having some sort of operation, you're having some sort of test, you're having some sort of interview, you got some terrible disease which has never been cured before, or whatever. It's always got to be a first time. Maybe it'll be you. And sorry, there's too many examples I've had of that. The incurable diseases. People who should have been dead years ago and they're still breathing, maybe even here. All those times when people just, okay, I think I told this on a retreat I gave in over in Kuala Lumpur recently. But this was the guy from Sydney, the guy who came on a meditation retreat. He was not a Buddhist. He told me he just came on his retreat because he was desperate. He had sinus cancer. A gentleman about 40 or 42 years of age, around then. And when he started meditating, he meditated noisily. Because he was always breathing through his mouth. That's the best he could do. So, when the first day there, I got all these complaints. Can you please tell people to breathe quietly? And it's understandable, but people don't breathe noisily on purpose. It's just the best they can do. When I told him that he did have a sinus cancer, big tumor in the bridge of his nose, and that's the best he could do, the first thing I noticed there was the compassion everybody gave him. They could just kind of realize what it must be like, you know, to be someone who's dying like that. And they said, breathe as loudly as you can. We don't mind at all. It's amazing when there's some disturbance and you give it kindness, you understand why, it doesn't really matter anymore. It doesn't cause as much distress when you realize why it is happening. Things are going wrong, not having the peace which you think is necessary for meditation. When you understand why, it doesn't matter so much. So you can tolerate it and make peace with it. So anyway, what he did, the end of the retreat, breathing loudly every day, every morning. And at the end of the retreat, I always recall him running towards the car. This was in Sydney, and I was already in the car, about to be taken to Sydney Airport to get the flight back to Perth. I do have a home, honestly, and that's here in Perth. And so he came running towards me. He said, "Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Brahm, don't go yet." I said, "What's happened?" He said, "The last meditation he did." And this is interesting for you to know, it's always the very last one where you don't expect anything. You've done it all, you've tried everything, nothing works, so you let go. But anyway, the last meditation, he said he heard the popping sound. Pop. And he could breathe through his nose. For 1 minute, only 1 minute, that's all. But at least he could breathe through his nose. It wasn't imagination. It was his nose, his breath. And it was going through. And it excited him so much. I think that's what, probably why it closed up again. But he came running out to me and said, "What do I do next?" Obviously, carry on. But also, honestly, I thought it was too late. I never thought he would survive. The tumor was too big. He left it. It's like doing your homework the night before the exam. Too late. But anyway, what happened next was about 6 months later, in another gig in another place in Sydney. I call them gigs because that's fair enough. A lot of people come to listen. I don't get paid, but nevertheless, it's like a gig. Anyway, this guy came up to me and said, "Do you remember me?" Shouldn't say that. But nevertheless, I said, "No, I'm honest. I don't remember you. Who the hell are you?" I know sometimes people get upset that I speak like that, but at least I'm connecting with them. And then he smiled. And he said he was that guy. And of course, he looked totally different. Because if you're dying of cancer, you've seen people dying of cancer. They're all thin, no flesh on their bones. They look like they're disappearing fast. He looked healthy. He said, "I'm in full remission. Thank you so much. It worked. I carried on doing what you taught me. And now that cancer is totally gone. I just want to come and say thank you to you. And also to let you know that I'm going to spend however many years I've got left in this life to teach this to others. To help others." It was a beautiful thing. He said, "Don't need to thank me. Give it forward, don't give it back." In other words, help teaching others. And so things like that are just, you know, wonderful stories about what you think has gone wrong. But then you make use of that and it becomes a really great changing point in your life. Another story, which I really haven't told for a long time, it just came up, was I received an invitation some many years ago now to give a talk, I think at that time, the Southern Department of the Education Department, the Southern Region Education Department, they were having a special seminar together somewhere in, actually I don't remember where it was now, but, and they asked me, "Can you please come along to give a keynote address?" And that was what it was, with a free breakfast. I think the free breakfast is what managed me to get me there. And I didn't know why I was invited. And this is, you turn up to these things, which are surprising. And as soon as I turned up there, this lady came up to me. She was some big shot in the education department. And she stood in front of me and said those words again, "Do you remember me?" I said, "No." And then she told me her story. She was the principal of, I think at the time it was, it was Kelmscott Primary School. And I had gone to give a talk there about, you know, Buddhism and mental disease or something, or Buddhism and education. And she'd listened. That's one of the stories which I had told, that if there's something to do, give it everything you've got. And she said, "I listened to that story, and then I thought, there's something I always wanted to do in my life as a teacher. And so that night she wrote out her resignation letter to the education department. She was a very highly valued principal. And she said what she had seen, there's many kids in Perth who'd fallen through the cracks in the system. You know, young girls who were prostitutes, young boys who were just so into drugs, and they were sort of 15 or 16, even younger than that. And she said these were children who'd missed out and no one was helping them, the two difficult cases. So she went to the education department after resigning and got some sort of funding. She really knew a few people after all those years of being a principal of a primary school in Kelmscott. And she managed to get funding for this. That she went to those bridges at night time, to those places where these kids would hang out, got to know them, and said, "No, what sort of things can the education department do for you? We don't expect you to go back to school because that doesn't work for you. What do you need?" And she did that research, presented it to the education department, and got this special program. This was so many years ago. This special program for children who were homeless, which they'd lost their families. Basically, no one cared for them. And they're just managing to get by, stealing drugs, prostitution. And she got their trust and got a few of them. So back into a program, managed to get some spaces in some schools which weren't being used. So when they needed to come, when they wanted to come, they could come and get some kind of education. And she said, that just came from, you know, that your inspiration many years ago, Ajahn Brahm. And so I gave a talk, but then the person who gave a talk right after me was this 17-year-old. One of the kids she found under the bridge told his story about how he'd been physically abused as a young kid, how he'd been just no way was understood at school and just felt like a failure, no hoper. And he was he totally made my talk feel just so stupid, I must admit. Because he said, he's now been offered a place at university. He's one of the success stories of what had happened when somebody cared. And it wasn't a sense of like something had gone wrong. There was a problem. Let's make sure this problem is solved. And that's why they had this special ceremony. The breakfast wasn't really what I got out of that. It was the inspiration to see how some of these stories can really, really, really work. And they can change people's lives and give a kid. This was about 10 or 15 years ago. I don't know what happened to those kids, what happened to those programs. We always need new programs, new ways of finding people who do move through the cracks and who just haven't really got a life. There must be some ways we can look after them. And that's why sometimes you have some very inspirational people who get out there and do some amazing stuff. What's one of those other nice stories which somebody told me about an indigenous kid up north somewhere, and he's really young, and the magistrate at one of these court cases said, this is not the first time you've been in front of me. You know, you should be sent to some detention centre somewhere, but I'm not going to do that. It's obviously not working. And just the magistrate said, if you can keep your nose clean for 6 months, I'll buy you a bicycle out of the judge's own money. And the kid did that. He just gave him something to strive for, something good, and just the kindness of the magistrate out of his own money doing this. Wonderful, yeah, we'll do that. And so eventually he kept his nose clean with the help of many people. And to see the judge, the magistrate, in the big picture in the newspaper, giving this kid a nice expensive bike for himself. That's the kind of thing which works. That's why even with the police every now and again, I remember hearing that they were wanting to, instead of fine people for speeding or for, you know, to running the red lights at intersections, instead of doing the negative, punishing people when they make mistakes, how about rewarding them when they drive well? You know, when you do slow down, you do let other people in, when you do drive responsibly. And I remember reading this story about this guy. He was driving a car and the policeman stopped him. And the policeman said, no need to worry, sir. We stopped you because we've been watching you driving and your driving is so wonderful. You know, that you've done a wonderful job. You've been very kind, letting people come in. You know, not going too fast, not going too close to the people in front of you, passing bicycles properly. So, it is our great pleasure to give you a $200 reward for your good driving. And they gave him this $200 reward. And the guy, and they said, well, you know, just for our records, we want to know what you'd be using this for. And he said, oh, well, the first thing I'll do is to get a proper driving test, to get a license. So of all those stories, that's probably the one you remember the most, because sometimes it's humorous. And so putting that humour and that meaning into spirituality, that's really, really important. And so that's one of the reasons why when we add the piece of humour there, it makes it so that people remember what you're saying. Sometimes I've asked people after the talk, what do you remember from the talk this evening? And I say, remember the joke. What else did I say? Oh, I don't know. Kind of forget. But there's something which is actually kind and helpful in there. And so whatever happens in your life, you know, when so-called things go wrong, just can we not change that word over? Again, when I was a school teacher, I was taught something. As a school teacher, I was much more open in those days than when I was a school kid. I was just, you know, trying to follow the rules and trying to get by. But once you were a school teacher, I finally learned what mistakes, what wrong marks were about. That was when, that time, I had to set the exam. I was a maths teacher, so you had to set an exam in maths at the end of the year. I'd never done that before. I didn't feel right about exams. Already, I mentioned here that whenever I did exams in the exam room, I wanted to help my friends. I was smart, you know, so I knew what I was doing. So if they were struggling over a question, I wanted to help them. And the teacher said, that's cheating. It's not cheating, it's compassion. Isn't it the case? In real life, if there's something you can't do, you ask somebody you know, a good friend who can help you. That's not cheating, that's kindness. That's the way the world works. So I never liked exams when it was just so individual and trying to beat the opposition or your friends. And I really hated that. But anyway, that when I had to set an exam, that was something totally different. There's two things I remember doing. The first thing was asking, you know, how hard should it be? And this teacher said, try and set the exam not too hard. Try and aim for an average score of 70%, 7 out of 10. I said, why is that? And he said, if it's 7 out of 10, if you get an exam, you score 70%. That's a pretty good score at school. So you think you can do math, you can do English, you can do history. 7 out of 10 is okay. But the 3 out of 10 where they make mistakes, that is for you, their teacher. So you can understand what part of what you've been teaching them they haven't fully understood yet. That's a place of growth. That's a place where the school kids can learn some more on the next lessons. And when I heard that, you made that the next step that that's life. If in your life you score 100%, life's not worth anything. It's just too easy. You don't learn, you don't grow. If you score 40%, you get depressed. If you score an average of 70%, that's the very best, because it means you can do life, and that 30% where you make mistakes, where it all goes wrong, it's not wrong. That's where the growth happens. That's where you learn so much. That's where you can innovate. You can realize what's not working in this world. You know, we have our great economies. Sometimes some of them go wrong. That's where we can learn how to change from sort of, you know, using fossil fuels to something like solar or something. We can learn different ways of doing things. We can learn to work from home. We can learn to use the internet more. We can learn to let our senior monks have 10 days off every now and again. It's not that things go wrong. It's opportunities arise for doing things differently. When you see that, you know, that some kids are not being looked after and they could be great people, why can't we just find a different way of doing things to innovate? So that's where the 70% rule became an important part of my life. I never expect people to laugh at my jokes all the time. 70% and I'm very happy. And it's also everything else you do. Look at this place here. It's not a bad place. I think 70% of you park appropriately. It's the other 30% which causes poor Bill a lot of trouble. So try your very best. And so we don't call it wrong. And this was precisely what I saw in the teachings of the Buddha, especially for the monks. We have our Vinaya rules. It never gave me a sense of guilt and just the burden of having to keep all these rules and be a goody-goody. Instead, they always say, if you do make a mistake, didn't say do it wrong, you make a mistake, you let somebody else know and do it better next time. That's called growth. Whatever you do in your life, if you meditate and you can't meditate, you fall asleep or you go crazy. I've never had anyone gone real crazy when they're meditating. Gone crazy when they don't meditate, yeah, but not when they meditate. But so if it doesn't work out, admit it. Don't be ashamed of it. It's not wrong. And try again. Those of you who have relationships and it doesn't work out, you don't ever think the relationship's gone wrong. You made mistakes. Learn from it. Try again. It's called growth. It's called learning. How else can you learn if you don't give it a try? Being a monk. That's what happens being a monk or being a nun. There's lots of things to learn. Lots of places where you can make mistakes. When people make a mistake and it's wrong, they learn, they grow. That's one of my problems. Because there's too many monks now. I don't know where to put them all. Oh my goodness. They don't want to leave. Yeah. That's good. And anyway, it's nice being able to go over to places like where I just went to before the New Year, to Malaysia and Singapore. And they were all sort of saying what a wonderful thing it is that some of these monks now go over to those places to teach. You know, the monk they were really praising, Venerable Sunyo, he came and gave a talk here as well, I believe. Yep. Yeah. And he said, it's wonderful to see some of the results of your monk factory. That's what I called it. Bodhinyana Monastery, and also Kusala Vihara, the Albany Vihara, and Dhammasara Nuns Monastery. That's my nun factory. So you put the... put the raw products in and you turn it around through the conveyor belt and produce these really inspiring monks and nuns and lay people as well. It's a factory. I kind of like that idea, because you come over here, you may think that these products which come in are just really hopeless. Who was I talking to that with somebody about recently? Some of the monks I've ordained, I thought, my God, what am I doing this for? It's really going to be troublesome. But then you give them a chance, and they go into these amazing monks. Some of the nuns who ordained, somebody said, don't ordain her, please. You don't know what she's like. Maybe I don't know what she's like. We have an idea what she could be like. And that's what gives you the kindness and the gentleness to let it happen and create these beautiful things in this world for each one of you. So that each one of you can come here and gain something, you know, from the Friday night talks, the Saturday afternoon meditations, and just also the good friendship afterwards. So I wish you all a very happy evening. And we have, unfortunately, I'm not going anywhere for the next few weeks, so you're going to be stuck with me for Friday nights. And also Saturday afternoons and Sundays as well. So may you all be happy and well. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Hey, come on, you can do better than that. Remember what I said, whatever you do, give everything you've got. So we'll do the questions in a moment. But first of all, the three sadhus properly this time, please. Give it everything you've got. One, two, three. Sadhu. 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 That feels much happier. You know what sadhu means? Awesome, yes. Another translation would be wicked, but I mean, I don't think that really fits as well as awesome does. So now we have some questions. Any questions from the floor, first of all? We'll do the ones from overseas. Okay. Overseas questions first of all, then. Here we go. Today we have from British Columbia, from Houston, from Indonesia, from Germany, and from Estonia. I'll do the one from Estonia, first of all. Dear Ajahn, is sukha dukkha? In other words, is there any experience which is not dukkha? It's a very deep question. That the answer is they got it correct here. Everything is an irritation, but then there's some happinesses which we think are really nicely happy, such as I don't know, maybe your cricket team winning or something. Is that happiness? Yeah, it's happy, but it's a lot of suffering because you have to win next time as well, and there's no end to that. Whatever happiness, seeing your favorite movie. Well, after you've seen your favorite movie, then what? So there's something about even the happy moments of life, they don't last. And you always want them to be repeated. And sometimes it's the story of lesser returns. You have to have more visual effects, just more better jokes, more better delivery from Ajahn Brahm, newer stories. And sometimes it goes endless. So. But then when you get to some meditation, that starts to get really interesting. It gets to a much deeper level of sukha. Sukha is like happiness, joy, really blissful. Believe in that, okay, that sometimes some people get to this incredible meditations called first jhana. Some of those first jhana, it's when Christian mystics used to do this, only a few of them, they used to call it like union with God. Blissed out of their heads. But then you find out there's more than that. There's a second jhana. And that really just blows your mind. You can have more bliss than pure love. And then after that, there's a third jhana. You think, how many more of these jhanas are there? How many more so what happiness is? And that's one of the reasons why, you know, compared to, say, third jhana, second jhana is just... You can't call it real happiness. And this is going to bliss states. Well, afterwards, when you come out afterwards from these bliss states, you're just walking on air for such a long time. You're in the clouds. The afterglow is just really impressive. So anyway, this is some of the bliss states of deep meditation. So you got it right. But nevertheless, the suffering of some of these really deep happinesses in deep meditation, they're good enough for the time being. Anyway, from I'm going backwards here, from Germany. Please explain how equanimity can go with compassion and loving kindness. Equanimity seems observing without attachment or feelings. How can you care with equanimity? It's a very good question. That's one of the reasons why these days the word upekkha, it does literally mean just looking on. But I prefer using the term contentment now for that equanimity. Because I totally agree with Wolfram from Germany here that sometimes when you have this beautiful quality which is called, you know, upekkha in Buddhism, to call it equanimity seems to be too cold. You call it contentment. And contentment has this beautiful joy and happiness with it. And even though when the Buddha said about the fourth jhana, who go in the jhanas again, which is based on equanimity, they always call it the happiness of equanimity, upekkha sukha. So there's still that joy there. It's got a quality to it which is emotional, which is joyful, which is not just cold. It's not like the equanimity of a robot. It's not artificial intelligence. This is the joy to it, a very powerful, deep happiness. It's one of the reasons why I prefer to translate that upekkha as contentment. You don't want anything in the whole world, and it's gorgeous being in that contentment. From Indonesia, next question. I've seen persons with power acted said unpleasant things to their subordinates. Why do they do that? Could you please remind us again how to stand up and deal with such a bully? First of all, don't be a bully yourself. You don't have as much power if you have to tell somebody what to do. Instead, inspire somebody what to do. And it's something from the Chinese Art of War, which I remember reading, which really impressed me. The general in the Imperial Chinese Army many centuries ago, who had the best discipline in the whole of the Chinese armies. And so the emperor wanted to find out his secret. Why do your soldiers always do what you ask them to do? You know, even it means getting up early and training, going into battle, you know, risking their lives. Why do they do that? And the general said, because I only tell my soldiers to do what they want to do. How can they want to get up so early in the morning? How can they want to, you know, go and fight these battles where they'll probably get killed or wounded? He said it's a motivation. That general was this wonderful motivator. So he could talk to them, inspire them, encourage them. So they wanted to get up early in the morning. They wanted to actually, I don't know how you could do this, to sacrifice yourself for some higher cause, to do something which would save the lives and the culture of the people they really cared about. It's the same in school. If you want your kids to do well at school, inspire them. Don't make them afraid of punishment. And so this is actually what the general did. So he never needed to shout at his troops. So they just, wait, please, tell us where we can get up. We want to get up now, please, please. The same when you meditate. The monks in Bodhinyana Monastery, I try and live like that. To make sure I never tell the monks what time to get up in the morning. He says, when do you want to get up? On retreats. You've heard me say that many times before, those of you who have gone on retreats with me. So when you need to get up in the morning, then get up. You don't have to get up. I'm not going to shout. You're not going to go to your room and drag you out of bed. He says, when you need to get up, get up. You encourage and inspire people. And that works so much, 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 much better. You don't need to bully anybody to explain to them just why. Why do you want to stay in bed for? It's a beautiful day outside. You can get some great peace outside. So anyway, that's if there is somebody, stand up and deal with such bullies. The best way is to ignore them if you possibly can. Stand up to them, it's almost like you're bullying them back. You're just giving them what they're trying to give you, but you're in a weaker position. If it's at all possible, just ignore them. Just do your job as best you possibly can. And if you're a good worker, you can ignore them and they can shout at you. and you just don't even just respond. Just do the good work. It's a tough thing to do, but really the big mistake there is just with the people who in management think you have to bully to get things done. Honestly, Venerable Metaji, am I a bully? You better answer properly, otherwise you'll be in big trouble. No. That's not how I teach. Do you want to answer?
No. I said no.
Okay, good. Great. This one's from Houston. I have trouble juggling school, a job, and a social life. How can I care for all three without burning myself out? I try to eat healthily and sleep, but I am tired. Sometimes you can't do all three. So you have to give priority to some things over others. So I don't know which one you want to do the most. But again, I have to be very careful of burning myself out, because I almost did, just 2 or 3 weeks ago. I think I have enough awareness of how much I can take, and just it only takes 2 or 3 days in my cave, honestly, and just get your energy back again. But you've got to be careful that you manage to get to the cave rather than the hospital. So this is my 72nd year. I'm an old monk now. Anyway, juggling school, a job, and a social life, you have to give yourself priorities and have to be able to say no to some things. Because otherwise, eat healthy and sleep, but I am tired. Do you really sleep well? This is one thing which was really clear to me as a 70-year-old, having the opportunity to take a good rest without no one bothering you. The place where I sleep in my cave has got 2 big doors, it's underground, and I don't know what happens outside. People could just be having a riot outside, and I wouldn't know. And so you have that quietness, that peace, and that comfort in a cave, and that's a wonderful place to stay. So many years ago, I thought if somebody was wanting to start a really nice company, make a little bit of money, but also make lots of good karma, if you can get a nice, quiet place somewhere just outside of Perth, and not just have a monastery, just have a place where people can sleep. Whatever, any time of day or night, they can just sleep there, have nice food, and you obviously have to pay for it, but that's all. Not nature walks, not teaching people anything, not educating people, not meditating. If they want to meditate, they can, but not teaching anything. Just a place where you can have a nice bed, and you can just go to bed there and wake up when you want and have a nice breakfast and go back to sleep again afterwards, however long you need. Just a sleep retreat. How many people would want to go there? See, the demand is there, but you have a retreat like that and you always have to do something. Go and meditate, listen to a talk or something, or go and do some fence posts. So anyway, this is a different way of looking. So if anybody wants to try that, it'd be a great little money earner for you. Anyway, our last one from British Columbia. How can I reduce my anger? I feel a lot of rage when I think about how much injustice is in the world when I feel like people treat me poorly. For goodness sake, if you get angry, you don't see an accurate picture of the world. Remember when I said about the 2 bad bricks in the wall and I wanted to destroy that wall? Because all I ever saw was the bad stuff in that wall. It's almost you get obsessed. You can only see things in one particular way. And I'd have been willing to blow up that wall and start all over again. Instead, somebody told me it wasn't such a bad wall. And when they pointed out the 998 good bricks in the wall, I never needed to destroy that wall anymore. You think about how much injustice there is in the world. Yeah, there is injustice in this world, but it's also amazing just the way that justice kind of balances its way out in the end. It's the law of karma in the end. And that's one of my sayings, no need to seek for revenge.
The bastards will get you in the end.
Yeah. karma will get you in the end. No, karma will get the bastards in the end. That's what it was supposed to be. Please excuse the language there, but people remember that. Sometimes it's, as a monk, the Buddha actually said this, you're supposed to speak in the local language. The language which you use is what I'm supposed to use, according to what the Buddha said, but there's somebody who said, no. Some words Ajahn Brahm you shouldn't say. Like bullshit. So you know I don't say that word, except every now and again. Instead, we use a Pali word. It's called Gomayang. I use it in Pali, because the word for ball is go, and Mayang is what comes out of the backside of a ball. So when I say Gomayang, you know what I mean. So it's really Gomayang to think that anger can be justified at all. Please calm your own anger, first of all, and you can see the world in a different way. We justify our anger. Is it really ever justified? Disappointment, yes. Sometimes frustration. But never let anger just taint the way you look at this world. Otherwise you won't see any kindness at all, no beauty, no anything. You just get so angry. And that doesn't give the persons you're getting angry about an opportunity to grow. Anyway, treat you poorly. They probably do, but at least may there be one person in this world. This is a person from British Columbia. Somebody who never treats you poorly. And that's yourself. Please be kind to yourself. That's most important. You know, at least one person in this world who is kind to you. They may treat you poorly, but don't treat yourself poorly. When I get up in the morning, I still do this. Get up, look at myself in the mirror, and do my 10 push-ups. That's really helpful. When you go overseas and lots of people want to take photographs of you, how can you keep on smiling when they're taking photographs of you? Just training, that's all, just training. Okay, thank you all for listening. Is there any questions from the floor before we finish? Oh, you got one there? The question I was just about to finish. No, you just, not a question, just. Oh, no. That'd be a quick one. Okay, it's quick enough. Oh,
yeah, it's very
that's very nice.
The robber, similar to the monster,
yeah.
But don't you think most of us, the problem in the world is...
Yeah. Oh, sorry, what is that? Oh, you give a very powerful talk, Anjibar.
Yeah.
It's one of the best talks I've ever heard before in my life. Then yeah.
Let's leave it as it is, we don't want to spoil it.
Sorry?
No, carry on.
Yeah. You know about the rob. You talk about the robber, similar to the monster. You know. Mm. Yeah. Don't you think, Ajahn Brahm, we human beings, we are led by our false ego. You know. So we are false ego. So we are blinded by what's actually going on. You know. That's where the problem are. The thing. If can lower. The ego, and show some kindness. You know.
Yeah.
Like say the war in the world now, this thing, then.
So you know how to
solve
that?
A lot of problems could be solved.
Do you know how to solve that?
Yeah.
Come here next Friday. Okay, thank you very much.
You've spoken all. Thanks very much for the talk.
Okay, no, my pleasure, Eddie. It's always nice hearing you. So now we can pay respects to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and then those people who wish to stay for a bit longer, most welcome. And those people who need to leave, they can leave.
Arahant Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhan Bhagavantam Abhivadeti Suakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammayana. Supatipano Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghan Namami.
And for those people who are just worried about bowing, what we bow to is not a sort of some god or something. We bow to what that thing represents behind me. Things like virtue, peace, and compassion. And I love bowing to virtue, goodness, it's so important to me in life. And peace, wherever you find peace, and kindness. So next time you want to bow to virtue, peace, and compassion, 3 bows is really good for you. You don't have to, though. Okie dokie. See you next time.